Dune, House Harkonnen, by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, Part 1. This complete book consists of 603 pages. Part 1 consists of pages 1 through 324. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Dune, House Harkonnen, continues the unforgettable saga begun in Dune, House Atreides. As a vast array of rich and complex figures strive to shape a sprawling universe of mystery and madness, promise and wonder. The vivid universe revealed in the thrilling pages of Frank Herbert's Dune. At last, Shaddam sits on the Golden Lion throne, his precarious position as ruler of the known universe dependent on producing a male heir. But his leadership is further threatened by the ambitious Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, whose insatiable thirst for dominance leads him to plot against some of the most powerful forces in the Imperium, hoping to elevate his own ruthless house to unprecedented heights of power. His primary targets, House Atreides and the mysterious Bene Gesserit Sisterhood. The Sisterhood are unaware of this threat, as they prepare to culminate the work of centuries in the creation of a god-child who will sweep away emperors, houses, and history itself in a terrifying new order of religious tyranny. The desert world Dune, the machine world Ix, and countless other conquered planets groan under the numbing slavery of cruel new masters determined to exploit their resources. Most notably, the addictive spice melange, found only on Dune. But small bands of renegades begin to fight back, lighting the spark of freedom against overwhelming odds. New, unexpected heroes arise. Young and resourceful Liet Kynes on Dune, wily and patient Kater on Ix, and the unyielding Gurney Halleck on Gedi Prime, driven to vengeance against his Harkonnen overlords. For Leto Atreides, grown complacent and comfortable as ruler of his house, it is a time of momentous choice between love and honor, friendship and duty, safety and destiny. Leto has finally produced an heir to House Atreides, Victor, and will make whatever choices necessary to protect the young boy and ensure his legacy as Duke. Ultimately, however, for House Atreides there is just one choice: strive for greatness or be crushed. Brian Herbert, the son of Frank Herbert, is the author of numerous acclaimed science fiction novels, including Sidney's Comet, Sudana Sudana, Prisoners of Arion, The Race for God, a Nebula Award nominee, and Man of Two Worlds, written with Frank Herbert. He has also written Dreamer of Dune, a comprehensive biography of his illustrious father. Kevin J. Anderson has written 26 national bestsellers and has been nominated for the Nebula Award, the Bram Stoker Award, and the SFX Reader's Choice Award. He also set the Guinness World Record for largest single-author book signing. Dedication. To our mutual friend Ed Kramer, without whom this project would never have come to fruition. He provided the spark that brought us together. Acknowledgements. Jan Herbert, with appreciation for her unflagging devotion and constant creative support. Penny Merritt, for helping manage the literary legacy of her father, Frank Herbert. Rebecca Moesta Anderson's tireless support and enthusiasm for this project. Her ideas, imagination, and sharp eyes truly enhanced this project. Robert Gottlieb and Matt Bialer of the William Morris Agency. Mary Alice Keir and Anna Cottle of CineLit Representation, all of whom never wavered in their faith and dedication, seeing the potential of the entire project. Erwin Applebaum and Nita Taublib at Bantam Books, gave their support and attention to such an enormous undertaking. Pat Labruto's excitement and dedication to this project, from the very start, helped to keep us on track. He made us consider possibilities and plot threads that made Dune, House Harkonnen, even stronger and more complex. Picking up the editorial reins, Anna Leslie Grohl and Mike Stoll offered excellent advice and suggestions, even at the 11th hour. Our UK editor, Carolyn Cowie, for continuing to find things that everyone else missed, and for her suggestions on details, large and small. And Gregory, for editorial work on an export edition of Dune House Atreides that occurred too late to list her in the credits. As always, Catherine Sidor at Wordfire Incorporated worked tirelessly to transcribe dozens of microcassettes and type many hundreds of pages to keep up with our manic work pace. Her assistance in all steps of this project has helped to keep us sane, and she even fools other people into thinking we're organized. Diane E. Jones and Diane Davis Hurt worked hard as test readers and guinea pigs, giving us honest reactions and suggesting additional scenes that helped make this a stronger book. The Herbert Limited Partnership, including Ron Merritt, David Merritt, Byron Merritt, Julie Herbert, Robert Merritt, Kimberly Herbert, Margot Herbert, and Teresa Shackelford, all of whom have provided us with their enthusiastic support, entrusting us with the continuation of Frank Herbert's magnificent vision. Beverly Herbert, for almost four decades of support and devotion to her husband, Frank Herbert. And, most of all, thanks to Frank Herbert, whose genius created such a wondrous universe for all of us to explore. Discovery is dangerous, but so is life. A man unwilling to take risks is doomed never to learn, never to grow, never to live. Planetologist Pardit Kynes. An Arrakis Primer, written for his son, Leet. When the sandstorm came howling up from the south, Pardit Kynes was more interested in taking meteorological readings than in seeking safety. His son, Leet, only 12 years old, but raised in the harsh ways of the desert, ran an appraising eye over the ancient weather pod they had found in the abandoned botanical testing station. He was not confident the machine would function at all. Then Leet gazed back across the sea of dunes toward the approaching tempest. "The wind of the demon in the open desert, Ulasi Kaliwala." Almost instinctively, he checked his stillsuit fittings. "Coriolis storm," Kynes corrected, using a scientific term instead of the Freeman one his son had selected. "Winds across the open flatlands are amplified by the planet's revolutionary motion. Gusts can reach speeds up to 700 kilometers per hour." As his father talked, the young man busied himself sealing the egg-shaped weather pod, checking the vent closures, the heavy doorway hatch, the stored emergency supplies. He ignored their signal generator and distress beacon. The static from the sandstorm would rip any transmissions to electromagnetic shreds. In pampered societies, Leet would have been considered just a boy. But life among the hard-edged freemen had given him a tightly coiled adulthood that few others achieved even at twice his age. He was better equipped to handle an emergency than his father. The elder Kynes scratched his sandy gray beard. "A good storm like this can stretch across 4 degrees of latitude." He powered up the dim screens of the pod's analytical devices. "It lifts particles to an altitude of 2,000 meters and suspends them in the atmosphere, so that long after the storm passes, dust continues to fall from the sky." Leet gave the hatch lock a final tug, satisfied that it would hold against the storm. "The Freeman call that El Sayal, the rain of sand." "One day, when you become planetologist, you'll need to use more technical language," Pardit Kynes said in a professorial tone. I still send the Emperor occasional reports, though not as often as I should. I doubt he ever reads them. He tapped one of the instruments. Ah, I believe the atmospheric front is almost upon us. Leet removed a porthole cover to see the oncoming wall of white, tan, and static. A planetologist must use his eyes as well as scientific language. Just look out the window, Father. Kynes grinned at his son. It's time to raise the pod. Operating long-dormant controls, he managed to get the dual bank of suspensor engines functioning. The pod tugged against gravity, heaving itself off the ground. The mouth of the storm lunged toward them, and Leet closed the cover plate, hoping the ancient meteorological apparatus would hold together. He trusted his father's intuition to a certain extent, but not his practicality. The egg-shaped pod rose smoothly on suspensors, buffeted by precursor breezes. Ah, there we are, Kynes said. Now our work begins. The storm hit them like a blunt club and vaulted them high into the maelstrom. Days earlier, on a trip into the deep desert, Pardet Kynes and his son had discovered the familiar markings of a botanical testing station, abandoned thousands of years before. Freeman had ransacked most of the research outposts, scavenging valuable items, but this isolated station in an armpit of rock had gone undiscovered until Kynes spotted the signs. He and Leet had cracked open the dust and crusted hatch to peer inside like ghouls about to enter a crypt. They were forced to wait in the hot sun for atmospheric exchange to clear out the deadly stale air. Pardet Kynes paced in the loose sand, holding his breath and poking his head into the darkness, waiting until they could enter and investigate. These botanical testing stations had been built in the golden age of the old empire. Back then, Kynes knew, this desert planet had been nothing special, with no resources of note, no reason to colonize. When the Zensuni wanderers had come here after generations of slavery, they'd hoped to build a world where they could be free. But that had been before the discovery of the spice melange, the precious substance found nowhere else in the universe. And then everything had changed. Kynes no longer referred to this world as Arrakis, the name listed in imperial records, but instead used the Freeman name, Dune. Though he was by nature Freeman, he remained a servant of the Padishah emperors. Elrud the Ninth had assigned him to unravel the mystery of the spice, where it came from, how it was formed, where it could be found. For 13 years, Kynes had lived with the desert dwellers. He had taken a Freeman wife, and he'd raised a half-Freeman son to follow in his footsteps, to become the next planetologist on Dune. Kynes's enthusiasm for this planet had never dimmed. He thrilled at the chance to learn something new, even if he had to thrust himself into the middle of a storm. The pod's ancient suspensors hummed against the Coriolis howl like a nest of angry wasps. The meteorological vessel bounced on swirling currents of air, a steel-walled balloon. Wind-borne dust scoured the hull. This reminds me of the aurora storms I saw on Seleucia Secundus, Kynes mused. Amazing things, very colorful and very dangerous. The hammer wind can come up from out of nowhere and crush you flat. You wouldn't want to be caught outside. I don't want to be outside in this one either, Leet said. Stressed inward, one of the side plates buckled. Air stole through the breech with a thin shriek. Leet lurched across the deck toward the leak. He'd kept the repair kit and foam sealant close at hand, certain the decrepit pod would rupture. "We are held in the hand of God and could be crushed at any moment." "That's what your mother would say," the planetologist said without looking up from the skeins of information pouring through the recording apparatus into an old data pack. "Look, a gust clocked at 800 kilometers per hour." His voice carried no fear, only excitement. What a monster storm! Leet looked up from the stone-hard sealant he had slathered over the thin crack. The squealing sound of leaking air faded, replaced by a muffled hurricane din. If we were outside, this wind would scour the flesh off our bones. Kynes pursed his lips.
Quite likely true, but you must learn to express yourself objectively and quantitatively. Scour the flesh off our bones is not a phrasing one would include in a report to the Emperor.
The battering wind, the scraping sand, and the roar of the storm reached a crescendo. Then, with a burst of pressure inside the survey pod, it all broke into a bubble of silence. Leet blinked, swallowing hard to clear his ears and throat. Intense quiet throbbed in his skull. Through the hull of the creaking vessel, he could still hear Coriolis winds like whispered voices in a nightmare.
We're in the eye.
Glowing with delight, Pardet Kynes stepped away from his instruments. A siege at the center of the storm. A refuge where you would least expect it. Blue static discharges crackled around them, sand and dust rubbing together to generate electromagnetic fields.
I would prefer to be back in the siege right now, Leet admitted.
The meteorological pod drifted along in the eye, safe and silent after the intense battering of the storm wall. Confined together in the small vessel, the two had a chance to talk, as father and son. But they didn't. 10 minutes later, they struck the opposite sandstorm wall, thrown back into the insane flow with a glancing blow of the dust-thick winds. Leet stumbled and held on. His father managed to maintain his footing. The vessel's hull vibrated and rattled. Kynes looked at his controls, at the floor, and then at his son.
I'm not sure what to do about this. The suspensors are...
With a lurch, they began to plunge, as if their safety rope had been severed. Failing, Leet held himself against an eerie weightlessness as the crippled pod dropped toward the ground, which lay obscured by dusty murk. As they tumbled in the air, the planetologist continued to work the controls. The haphazard suspensors sputtered and caught again just before impact. The force from the Holtzman field generator cushioned them enough to absorb the worst of the crash. Then the storm pod slammed into the churned sand, and the Coriolis winds roared overhead like a spice harvester trampling a kangaroo mouse under its treads. A deluge of dust poured down, released from the sky. Bruised, but otherwise unharmed, Pardet and Leet Kynes picked themselves up and stared at each other in the afterglow of adrenaline. The storm headed up and over them, leaving the pod behind. After working a sand snork out through the clogged vent opening, Leet pumped fresh air into the stale confinement. When he pried open the heavy hatch, a stream of sand fell into the interior, but Leet used a static foam binder to pack the walls. Using a scoop from his Frem kit, as well as his bare hands, he set to work digging them out. Pardet Kynes had complete confidence in his son's abilities to rescue them, so he worked in dimness to collate his new weather readings into a single old-style data pack. Blinking as he pushed himself into the open air like an infant emerging from a womb, Leet stared at the storm-scoured landscape. The desert was reborn. Dunes moved along like a marching herd. Familiar landmarks changed. Footprints, tents, even small villages erased. The entire basin looked fresh and clean and new. Covered with pale dust, he scrambled up to more stable sand, where he saw the depression that hid the buried pod. When they'd crashed, the vessel had slammed a crater into the wind-stirred desert surface, just before the passing storm dumped a blanket of sand on top of them. With Freeman instincts and an inborn sense of direction, Leet was able to determine their approximate position, not far from the south false wall. He recognized the rock forms, the cliff bands, the peaks and rills. If the winds had blown them a kilometer farther, the pod would have crashed into the blistering mountains. An ignominious end for the great planetologist, whom the Freemen revered as their Ummah, their prophet. Leet called down into the hole that marked the buried vessel.
"Father, I believe there's a siege in the nearby cliffs. If we go there, the Freemen can help us dig out the pod."
"Good idea," Kynes answered, his voice muffled. "Go check to make sure. I'll stay here and work. I've got an idea."
With a sigh, the young man walked across the sand toward the jutting elbows of ochre rock. His steps were without rhythm, so as not to attract one of the great worms. Step, drag, pause. Drag, pause, step, step. Drag, step, pause, step. Leet's comrades at Red Wall Siege, especially his blood brother Warwick, envied him for all the time he spent with the planetologist. Ummah Kynes had brought a vision of paradise to the desert people. They believed his dream of reawakening Dune, and followed the man. Without the knowledge of the Harkonnen overlords, who were only on Arrakis to mine the spice, and viewed people only as a resource to be squeezed, Kynes oversaw armies of secret, devoted workers who planted grasses to anchor the mobile dunes. These freemen established groves of cacti and hardy scrub brushes in sheltered canyons, watered by dew precipitators. In the unexplored south polar regions, they had planted palmeries, which had gained a foothold and now flourished. A lush demonstration project at Plaster Basin produced flowers, fresh fruit, and dwarf trees. Still, though the planetologist could orchestrate grandiose, world-spanning plans, Leet did not trust his father's common sense enough to leave him alone for long. The young man went along the ridge until he found subtle blaze marks on the rocks. A jumbled path no outsider would notice. Messages in the placement of off-colored stones that promised food and shelter, under the respected Al-Amya traveler's benediction rules. With the aid of strong freemen in the siege, they could excavate the weather pod and drag it to a hiding place where it would be salvaged or repaired. Within an hour, the freemen would remove all traces and let the desert fall back into brooding silence. But when he looked back at the crash site, Leet was alarmed to see the battered vessel moving and lurching, already protruding a third of the way out of the sand. With a deep-throated hum, the pod heaved and strained, like a beast of burden caught in a Bela-Tajusan quagmire. But the pulsing suspensors had only enough strength to wrench the vessel upward a few centimeters at a time. Leet froze when he realized what his father was doing. Suspensors, out in the open desert! He ran, tripping and stumbling, an avalanche of powder sand following his footsteps. "Father, stop! Turn them off!" He shouted so loudly that his throat grew raw. With dread in the pit of his stomach, he gazed across the golden ocean of dunes, toward the hellish pit of the faraway Cielago Depression. He scanned for a telltale ripple, the disturbance indicating deep movement.
"Father, come out of there!"
He skidded to a stop in front of the open hatch as the pod continued to shift back and forth, straining. The suspensor fields thrummed. Grabbing the edge of the doorframe, Leet swung himself through the hatch and dropped inside the weather pod, startling Kynes. The planetologist grinned at his son.
"It's some sort of automated system. I don't know what controls I bumped into, but this pod just might lift itself out in less than an hour."
He turned back to his instruments. "It gave me time to collate all our new data into a single storage." Leet grabbed his father by the shoulder and pulled him from the controls. He slammed his hands down on the emergency cutoff switch, and the suspensors faded. Confused, Kynes tried to protest, but his son urged him toward the open hatch.
"Get out, now! Run as fast as you can toward the rocks!"
"But..." Leet's nostrils flared in angry exasperation.
"Suspensors operate on a Holtzman field, just like shields. You know what happens when you activate a personal shield out in the open sand?" The suspensors are working again. Kynes blinked. Then his eyes lit up as he understood.
Ah, a worm comes.
A worm always comes. Now run! The elder Kynes staggered out of the hatch and dropped to the sand. He recovered his balance and oriented himself in the glaring sun. Seeing the cliff line Leet had indicated, a kilometer away, he trudged off in a jerky, mismatched walk, stepping, sliding, pausing, hopping forward in a complicated dance. The young freeman dropped out of the hatch and followed along, as they made their way toward the safety of rocks. Before long, they heard a hissing, rolling sound from behind. Leet glanced over his shoulder, then pushed his father over a dune crest.
Faster! I don't know how much time we'll have.
They increased their pace. Pardet stumbled, got back up. Ripples arrowed across the sands directly toward the half-buried pod. Toward them. Dunes lurched, rolled, then flattened with the inexorable tunneling of a deep worm rising to the surface.
Run with your very soul!
They sprinted toward the cliffs, crossed a dune crest, slid down, then surged forward again, the soft sand pulling at their feet. Leet's spirits rose when he saw the safety of rocks less than 100 meters away. The hissing grew louder as the giant worm picked up speed. The ground beneath their boots trembled. Finally, Kynes reached the first boulders and clutched them like an anchor, panting and wheezing. Leet pushed him farther, though, onto the slopes, to be sure the monster could not rise from the sand and strike them. Moments later, sitting on a ledge, wordless as they sucked hot air through their nostrils to catch their breath, Pardet Kynes and his son stared back to watch a churning whirlpool form around the half-buried weather pod. In the loosening powder, as the viscosity of the stirred sand changed, the pod shifted and began to sink. The heart of the whirlpool rose up in a cavernous, scooped mouth. The desert monster swallowed the offending vessel along with tons of sand, forcing all the debris down into a gullet lined with crystal teeth. The worm sank back into the arid depths, and Leet watched the ripples of its passage, slower now, returning into the empty basin. In the pounding silence that followed, Pardet Kynes did not look exhilarated from his near brush with death. Instead, he appeared dejected. "We lost all that data." The planetologist heaved a deep breath. "I could have used our readings to understand those storms better." Leet reached inside a front pocket of his stillsuit and held up the old-style data pack he had snatched from the pod's instrument panel. "Even while watching out for our lives, I can still pay attention to research." Kynes beamed with fatherly pride. Under the desert sun, they hiked up the rugged path to the safety of the Seech. "Behold, O man, you can create life. You can destroy life. But lo, you have no choice but to experience life. And therein lies both your greatest strength and your greatest weakness." Orange Catholic Bible, Book of Kimla Septima, 5:3. On oil-soaked Gidi Prime, the work crew left the fields at the end of a typically interminable day. Encrusted with perspiration and dirt, the workers slogged from trench-lined plots under a lowering red sun, making their way back home. In their midst, Gurney Halleck, his blonde hair a sweaty tangle, clapped his hands rhythmically. It was the only way he could keep going, his way of resisting the oppression of Harkonnen overlords, who for the moment were not within earshot. He made up a work song with nonsense lyrics, trying to get his companions to join in, or at least to mumble along with the chorus. "We toil all day, the Harkonnen way, hour after hour, we long for a shower, just workin' and workin' and workin'." The people trudged along silently, too tired after 11 hours in the rocky fields
They hardly gave the would-be troubadour a notice. With a resigned sigh, Gurney finally gave up his efforts, though he maintained his wry smile. "We are indeed miserable, my friends, but we don't have to be dismal about it." Ahead lay a low village of prefabricated buildings, a settlement called Dmitri, in honor of the previous Harkonnen patriarch, the father of Baron Vladimir. After the Baron had taken control of House Harkonnen decades ago, he'd scrutinized the maps of Gedi Prime, renaming land features to his own tastes. In the process, he had added a melodramatic flair to the stark formations. Isle of Sorrows, Perdition Shallows, Cliff of Death. No doubt a few generations hence, someone else would rename the landmarks all over again. Such concerns were beyond Gurney Halleck. Though poorly educated, he did know the Imperium was vast, with a million planets and decillions of people. But it wasn't likely he'd travel even as far as Harko City, the densely packed, smoky metropolis that shed a perpetual ruddy glow on the northern horizon. Gurney studied the crew around him, the people he saw every day. Eyes downcast, they marched like machines back to their squalid homes, so sullen that he had to laugh aloud. "Get some soup in your bellies, and I'll expect you to start singing tonight. Doesn't the O.C. Bible say, 'Make cheer from your own heart, for the sun rises and sets according to your perspective on the universe?'" A few workers mumbled with faint enthusiasm. It was better than nothing. At least he had managed to cheer them up some. With a life so dreary, any spot of color was worth the effort. Gurney was 21. His skin already rough and leathery from working in the fields since the age of 8. By habit, his bright blue eyes drank in every detail, though the village of Dmitri and the desolate fields gave him little to look at. With an angular jaw, a too round nose, and flat features, he already looked like an old farmer and would no doubt marry one of the washed-out, tired-looking girls from the village. Gurney had spent the day up to his armpits in a trench, wielding a spade to throw out piles of stony earth. After so many years of tilling the same ground, the villagers had to dig deep in order to find nutrients in the soil. The Baron certainly didn't waste salaries on fertilizers. Not for these people. During their centuries of stewardship on Gedi Prime, the Harkonnens had made a habit of wringing the land for all it was worth. It was their right, no, their duty, to exploit this world, and then move the villages to new land and new pickings. One day, when Gedi Prime was a barren shell, the leader of House Harkonnen would undoubtedly request a different fief, a new reward for serving the Padishah emperors. There were, after all, many worlds to choose from in the Imperium. But galactic politics were of no interest to Gurney. His goals were limited to enjoying the upcoming evening, sharing a bit of entertainment and relaxation down at the meeting place. Tomorrow would be another day of back-breaking work. Only stringy, starchy kraal tubers grew profitably in these fields. Though most of the crop was exported as animal feed, the bland tubers were nutritious enough to keep people working. Gurney ate them every day, as did everyone else. Poor soil leads to poor taste. His parents and co-workers were full of proverbs, many from the Orange Catholic Bible. Gurney memorized them all and often set them to tunes. Music was the one treasure he was allowed to have, and he shared it freely. The workers spread out to their separate but identical dwellings, defective prefabricated units House Harkonnen had bought at discount and dumped there. Gurney gazed ahead to where he lived with his parents and his younger sister, Beth. His home had a brighter touch than the others. Old, rusted cookpots held dirt in which colorful flowers grew, maroon, blue, and yellow pansies, a shock of daisies,
even sophisticated-looking calla lilies. Most houses had small vegetable gardens where the people grew plants, herbs, vegetables. Though any produce that looked too appetizing might be confiscated and eaten by roving Harkonnen patrols. The day was warm and the air smoky, but the windows of his home were open. Gurney could hear Beth's sweet voice in a lilting melody. In his mind's eye, he saw her long, straw-colored hair. He thought of it as flaxen, a word from old Taran poems he had memorized, though he had never seen homespun flax. Only 17, Beth had fine features and a sweet personality that had not yet been crushed by a lifetime of work. Gurney used the outside faucet to splash the gray caked dirt from his face, arms, and hands. He held his head under the cold water, soaking his snarled blonde hair, then used blunt fingers to maul it into some semblance of order. He shook his head and strode inside, kissing Beth on the cheek while dripping cold water on her. She squealed and backed away, then returned to her cooking chores. Their father had already collapsed in a chair. Their mother bent over huge wooden bins outside the back door, preparing kraal tubers for market. When she noticed Gurney was home, she dried her hands and came inside to help Beth serve. Standing at the table, his mother read several verses from a tattered old O.C. Bible in a deeply reverent voice. Her goal was to read the entire mammoth tome to her children before she died. And then they sat down to eat. He and his sister talked while sipping a soup of stringy vegetables, seasoned only with salt and a few sprigs of dried herbs. During the meal, Gurney's parents spoke little, usually in monosyllables. Finishing, he carried his dishes to the basin, where he scrubbed them and left them to drip dry for the next day. With wet hands, he clapped his father on the shoulder. "Are you going to join me at the tavern? It's fellowship night." The older man shook his head. "I'd rather sleep. Sometimes your songs just make me feel too tired." Gurney shrugged. "Get your rest, then." In his small room, he opened the rickety wardrobe and took out his most prized possession, an old balisette, designed as a 9-stringed instrument, though Gurney had learned to play with only 7, since 2 strings were broken and he had no replacements. He had found the discarded instrument damaged and useless, but after working on it patiently for 6 months, sanding, lacquering, shaping parts, the balisette made the sweetest music he'd ever heard, albeit without a full tonal range. Gurney spent hours in the night strumming the strings, spinning the counterbalance wheel. He taught himself to play tunes he had heard, or composed new ones. As darkness enclosed the village, his mother sagged into a chair. She placed the precious Bible in her lap, comforted more by its weight than its words. "Don't be late," she said in a dry, empty voice. "I won't." Gurney wondered if she would notice if he stayed out all night. "I'll need my strength to tackle those trenches tomorrow." He raised a well-muscled arm, feigning enthusiasm for the tasks all of them knew would never end. He made his way across the packed dirt streets down to the tavern. In the wake of a deadly fever several years ago, 4 of the prefab structures had been left empty. The villagers had moved the buildings together, knocked down the connecting walls, and fashioned themselves a large community house. Although this wasn't exactly against the numerous Harkonnen restrictions, the local enforcers had frowned at such a display of initiative. But the tavern remained. Gurney joined the small crowd of men who had already gathered for the fellowship down at the tavern. Some brought their wives. One man already lay slumped across the table, more exhausted than drunk, his flagon of watery beer only half consumed. Gurney crept up behind him, held out his balisette, and strummed a jangling chord that startled the man to full wakefulness. Here's a new one, friends. Not exactly a hymn that your mothers remember, but I'll teach it to you.
He gave them a wry grin.
Then you'll all sing along with me and probably ruin the tune.
None of them were very good singers, but the songs were entertaining, and it brought a measure of brightness to their lives. With full energy, he tacked sardonic words onto a familiar melody.
O Giddy Prime, thy shades of black are beyond compare, from obsidian plains to oily seas, to the darkest nights in the Emperor's eye. Come ye from far and wide, to see what we hide in our hearts and minds, to share our bounty, and lift a pickaxe or two, making it all lovelier than before. O Giddy Prime, thy shades of black are beyond compare, from obsidian plains to oily seas, to the darkest nights in the Emperor's eye.
When Gurney finished the song, he wore a grin on his plain, blocky face and bowed to imagined applause. One of the men called out hoarsely,
Watch yourself, Gurney Halleck. If the Harkonnens hear your sweet voice, they'll haul you off to Harko for sure, so you can sing for the Baron himself.
Gurney made a rude noise.
The Baron has no ear for music, especially not lovely songs like mine.
This brought a round of laughter. He picked up a mug of the sour beer and chugged it down. Then the door burst open and Beth ran in, her flaxen hair loose, her face flushed.
Patrol coming. We saw the suspensor lights. They've got a prisoner transport and a dozen guards.
The men sat up with a jolt. Two ran for the doors, but the others remained frozen in place, already looking caught and defeated. Gurney strummed a soothing note on his balisette.
Be calm, my friends. Are we doing anything illegal? The guilty both know and show their crimes.
We are merely enjoying fellowship. The Harkonnens can't arrest us for that. In fact, we're demonstrating how much we like our conditions, how happy we are to work for the Baron and his minions, right, mates?
A somber grumbling was all the agreement he managed to elicit. Gurney set aside his balisette and went to the trapezoidal window of the communal hall, just as a prisoner transport pulled up in the center of the village. Several human forms could be seen in shadow behind the transport's plaza windows, evidence that the Harkonnens had been busy arresting people. All women, it appeared. Though he patted his sister's hand and maintained his good humor for the benefit of the others, Gurney knew the troopers needed few excuses to take more captives.